Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
What is it about Facebook's tactics of hooking young people that makes it similar to what Big Tobacco has done?
Facebook's own research about Instagram contains quotes from kids saying, "I feel bad when I use Instagram, but I also feel like I can't stop." Right? I know that the more time I spend on this, the worse I feel, but like I just can't, like that they want the next click, they want the next like.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Facebook knows that parents today, because they didn't experience these things, they never experienced this addictive experience with a piece of technology, they give their children bad advice. They say things like, "Why don't you just stop using it?" And so that Facebook's own research is aware that children express feelings of loneliness and struggling with these things because they can't even get support from their own parents.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen has now provided a trove of documents to the Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. But it was in her testimony before the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Protection this week that Haugen made the clearest assertions about just how much Facebook knows about how addictive its social media products actually are.
In the case of cigarettes, only about 10% of people who smoke ever get lung cancer, right? So the idea that, you know, 20% of your users could be facing serious mental health issues and that's not a problem is shocking. I also want to emphasize for people that eating disorders are serious, right? There are going to be women walking around this planet in 60 years with brittle bones because of choices that that Facebook made around emphasizing profit today. Or there are going to be women when they're in 20 years who want to have babies who can't because they're infertile as a result of eating disorders today.
Again and again, the question of profits versus addiction came up in Haugen's Senate testimony. Here are two more moments. First with Utah Senator Mike Lee, who displayed experimental ads that were never actually posted, but Facebook had approved them and could have reached more than 9 million teens. And then you'll hear Committee Chairman Senator Richard Blumenthal asking Haugen again about addictive content.
This first one has a colorful graphic encouraging kids to, quote, "throw a Skittles party like no other." This involves kids getting together randomly to abuse prescription drugs. The second graphic displays an Anna-tip. That is, a tip specifically designed to encourage and promote anorexia.
And has Facebook ever found, again, in its research, that kids show sign of addiction on Instagram?
Facebook has studied a pattern that they call problematic use, what we might more commonly call addiction. It has a very high bar for what it believes it is. It says you self-identify that you don't have control over your usage and that it is materially harming your health, your schoolwork, or your physical health. 5 to 6% of 14-year-olds have the self-awareness to admit both those questions. It is likely that far more than 5 to 6% of 14-year-olds are addicted to Instagram.
Blumenthal later made the connection explicit, saying, quote, "Facebook has taken Big Tobacco's playbook and has weaponized childhood vulnerabilities against children themselves." But it was Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, who began her testimony with not just an analogy to Big Tobacco, but with a call to action.
When we realized Big Tobacco was hiding the harms it caused, the government took action. When tobacco companies claimed that filtered cigarettes were safer for consumers, scientists could independently invalidate these marketing messages and confirm that, in fact, they posed a greater threat to human health. The public cannot do the same with Facebook. It is about Facebook choosing to grow at all costs, becoming an almost trillion-dollar company by buying its profits with our safety.
After Haugen's testimony, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg issued a statement saying, quote, The argument that we deliberately push content that makes people angry for profit is deeply illogical. But is it inaccurate? Is this Facebook's big tobacco moment? Well, in 1994, Congress called in the presidents and CEOs of the seven biggest American tobacco companies. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon asked each of them a simple question.
Nicotine is not addictive.
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes.
Mr. Johnston.
Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
And I too believe that nicotine is not addictive.
4 years later, in 1998, when the lies were embarrassingly obvious to the public, tobacco companies agreed to a so-called master settlement agreement with the attorneys general of 46 states. That, not the original revelation, was the big tobacco moment. Then Washington State AG Christine Gregoire announced the settlement.
The attorney generals have now before them a tobacco settlement proposal that would provide the states with $206 billion through the year 2025, the largest financial recovery in the history of the world, and would require the most sweeping changes in business practices ever imposed on an industry. It will change the way we see tobacco. Under this proposal, billboards, gone. Taxi and transit ads, gone. Hats, shirts, backpacks with tobacco brand names, gone. Joe Camel and any replacement for Joe Camel, gone. Instead of seeing these images every day, our children under this settlement proposal will finally see the truth.
Big tobacco's troubles weren't over yet. The federal government went after them next. And after a 9-month trial and years of appeals, the government won the case of United States v. Philip Morris USA et al. In 2009. Well, Sharon Eubanks was lead counsel for the government in that case, and today she's lead counsel at the National Whistleblower Center, and she joins us from Washington. Sharon Eubanks, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be with you, Meghna.
So you heard Senator Richard Blumenthal and others calling this Facebook's big tobacco moment. Is it?
I think you could say yes to that. I mean, for 50 years, the tobacco industry reigned supreme and avoided liability and regulation. And once the documents came out and they could no longer deny what they were doing, and the documents presented such an ugly picture of the things that the industry knew and hid from the public, that they had to come clean. And finally, in 2009, regulation happened. And the companies were regulated. It's not perfect regulation, but it's like any other. It's moving in that direction.
Okay, so this is really interesting because I would say that even though I'm talking to the lead counsel formerly for the government who argued against the big tobacco companies, I'm not entirely sure this is Facebook's big tobacco moment, right? Because you're describing a process with the tobacco companies that took, what, 15 years or so from the original revelations? And so take us through a couple of the major steps from the time that we heard, you know, that testimony from the tobacco CEOs all the way through your victory in U.S. v. Philip Morris.
Okay. Well, let's start with we filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, in 2009. There were three different causes of action we based that on, three different statutes. Under the motion to dismiss that was decided, the parts that were decided against the United States left only standing the RICO claim, Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a statute that the government has used to prosecute, criminals, the mafia. And so people didn't think that that was going to stand up. We pursued those claims and met all of the technical requirements for RICO, put on the witnesses, and, you know, ended basically the positions that ended their ability to take positions that in denial of the addictiveness of nicotine, the marketing to youth, and all of the different parts of the case that we'd put together. So the federal litigation, though, really wasn't the end of the story. because the court, having found that there were a RICO violation, said that that meant that it was likely that the companies would continue with those actions in the future. Taking a switch on the way they had presented their desires, one of the companies decided to support regulation. And again, long after the trial court in our case had decided in our favor in 2009, the power to regulate came about. Now, if you look at big tech and the parallel here, it's been 25 years of protections that they've had in place about regarding their litigation immunity. And that immunity has worked in their favor for 25 years. Now, the game changer, just like in tobacco, is in the documents. You can't unsee what's on those pages.
Okay.
Once you see the information that Facebook had at its fingertips, what it knew was going on about how its algorithm worked, and then see that they did nothing, normal people would be appalled by that. And it seems to me that in a switch of the way things often work, you have at least one member of the tech industry, Facebook here, saying, yes, we should be regulated. Let's do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, but Mark Zuckerberg has actually been saying that for quite some time, in a sense, so sort of like soft shoeing around the idea of federal regulation. My sense is because of the fact that he would like to help write those very same regulations. But
I agree completely with you. That's why he's doing it. And that was one of the imperfect parts of the 2009 Tobacco Control Act. The idea that typically regulated industries are part of the regulatory process, putting together even what it is they're required to do. I mean, we see this a lot in FDA, with the FDA, and how the industry works with them. And that's just not an uncommon thing. Of course, he wants to be able to help write it. But, you know, maybe that's not so necessary now that we have some documents. And I think some more documents should be coming our way to look at to determine what it is that they know, Facebook, that is, when they knew it, and what can be done about it.
Well, Sharon Eubanks, stand by for just a second, because there's a lot more I want to hear from you about really what it took to get from those original document revelations with Big Tobacco all the way through that 2009 case. So we are talking today about whether this is Facebook's Big Tobacco moment, and if not, what it would actually take to get there. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Hi, this is Bryce Johnson. I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, my name is Katie Smotherman. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Hello, my name is Mark Buzz from Buffalo, New York.
Hello, my name is Ariadne Matsukas, and I'm from the Big Island of Hawaii.
My name is Louise Height. I'm calling from Kenai, Alaska.
Hello, this is Teddy LaFon from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, my name is Charity Todd, and I'm calling from South Carolina.
Yeah, this is Robert B. McNabb, an educated hillbilly and certified old guy in Frankfort, Michigan.
Hi, my name is Clay Barlow, and I'm from Los Angeles. I quit Facebook because
Every time I was on it, I felt like I was drugged.
When I would get off of Facebook, I always was experiencing negative emotions.
But I was just burnt out.
I would get off of it feeling very sad and overwhelmed.
I found that it was making me feel more alone.
And I really felt like that was keeping us from connecting with phone calls and get-togethers. We were really substituting it for Facebook, you know, and it just became so nasty.
My thought process was, if I was using this as a reward for myself, on some level, I'm likely addicted to it.
I've seen the corrosive mind messing that they do.
The abuse, bullying, harassment of good people, including my 5 grandkids.
It was started as a meat market for college girls.
I'm someone who grew up with social media, so, you know, they had real dramatic effects on how I viewed myself. I would encourage people to delete it, even if it's just for a month. Give yourself that break and see what the difference is, because it's a dramatic difference in how you experience day-to-day life. Thank you.
Just a few of the avalanche of callers that we heard from about why they recently, or several years ago, quit Facebook. Now, admittedly, even that avalanche is a tiny drop in comparison to the billions of users who continue to use Facebook every day for reasons both bad and good. But we are talking today about whether or not this is Facebook's big tobacco moment, or more specifically, what would it take? What actions would attorneys general and the federal government need to take to truly make this Facebook's and big tech's big tobacco moment? And I'm joined today by Sharon Eubanks. She was lead counsel for the federal government in U.S. v. Philip Morris, the major federal case that the government won following the state cases that had been brought against the big tobacco companies. And Sharon, can you just give us a quick sense about how hard was it to litigate against big tobacco? What kind of effort did it take from you and your fellow attorneys to prosecute the case?
Well, it's hard to estimate just how hard it was in terms of the sheer numbers of people working on it. At one point, there were over 350 lawyers on the other side, and we had something like, at our largest number, maybe 32 or 33 lawyers. That kind of made us lean and mean. Scorched earth tactics left and right. A judge who wanted to make no mistakes on things that would be counted as reversible error. So we did a lot of things twice. We had a special master we had to go through before we could, oftentimes on most things, get before the court. So that meant two sets of briefs on just about any major issue. We had discovery went on for years, and we had to go through the materials that we received to determine how to use them. So it was review of an enormous amount of documents. But on the other side, what the industry did was it went after 24 agencies of the federal government to request documents from them. And the only way those documents could be produced were if we had a special order that said, you know, maybe you can claw back anything privileged, but you have to put the documents out there and give them to the other side. Personally, that was fine with me. I didn't need to fight over any of these things. The government wasn't being legitimately called on to defend anything that it had done. We were prosecuting the case against the industry. So it was hard. It was difficult. We had budget issues. Mitch McConnell was constantly saying he was going to cut off our funding, and it was a fight for everything right to the last moment in the courtroom when the case, which was filed under a Democratic president, under a Republican president's leadership, we just threw in the towel, or as in one of my colleagues put it, threw the case into the toilet. And that had to do with the remedies and everything we had worked so hard for. So it was very difficult, and it was great when the findings came out, a 1,700-page decision by the judge, basically adopting everything we had pushed forward and being detailed about it. So it was rewarding at the end of the day, but it certainly wasn't easy.
It sounded like a mighty slog, what you just described, actually. And I'm eager to also continue to hear from you what similarities, if any, you see in the position that the big tobacco companies took and the positions that big tech takes. Like, for example, after Frances Haugen's testimony before that Senate subcommittee this week was over, Facebook's vice president of content policy, Monica Bickert, took to the airwaves in several interviews. Here she is on CNN.
Is it true that Facebook uses these algorithms that push inflammatory content because that drives more clicks and engagement?
It is not true. And I want to say, I think there have been a lot of mischaracterizations today about what those stolen documents say.
So Sharon Eubanks, you heard Bickert saying stolen documents, mischaracterizations. She doesn't even mention Frances Haugen by name, just calls her a former employee. Do those corporate responses sound familiar to you?
Oh, they do. They trash the messenger. That's basically, you know, the same thing that happened with the tobacco industry. I mean, we had whistleblowers played a huge role in getting where we went with tobacco. I mean, whether it was Victor Denoble, Jeffrey Wigand, Merrill Williams, all of those whistleblowers brought forward information from the companies that we wouldn't have had. Right now, in looking at what Facebook has done, in fact, since 2017, the National Whistleblower Center and the Alliance to Counter Crime Online have filed several complaints about the various manners in which Facebook supports crime for profit. So that's something that I see, like the role of whistleblowers is something that's similar. But again, I can't emphasize enough how important the actual documents were. People can come forward and say whatever, but when you're looking at it on paper, letterhead of the company, then it's hard to deny it. Even though we have this, you know, this person coming forward and saying, oh, you know, of course we didn't do that. I mean, we had, you played in the opening here, the what we call the Seven Dwarfs tape, where they all raise their hand and say, I believe nicotine is not addictive. So that was something that we had to deal with. By the time we got to trial, however, not a single one of those CEOs was CEO.
Oh, interesting. You know, When documents are taken from the federal government and made public, those whistleblowers oftentimes go to jail. Frances Haugen worked for a private corporation. I presume, though, that she's probably concerned about action from Facebook because they keep calling them stolen documents. Did that also happen with the tobacco whistleblowers?
Well, yes, and some of the documents, in fact, were stolen by Merrill Williams, very famous for having taken documents out of the company. But that they even went to court in different states to try to prosecute Merrill Williams. So that's one of the scariest things. Someone once told me, in fact, it was David Kessler who headed the FDA. He told me that the way that these companies work is not to threaten your life, but it's to threaten your livelihood. And that is the big push that they put on to make it very hard for people to go forward or to set examples of, if you do this, then this is going to be our response. Yeah. It was a lot harder for the industry to do that against the United States of America. Mm. I mean, you know, there was no David in this, you know, Goliath fight. It was just, you know, a fight to the death, really, seriously.
Wow.
But again, what the content of those documents and the interpretation of the information that they contain and that the algorithms power how the platforms work and what everyone sees on their news feeds, that's something that is, you know, obviously needs to be looked at closely to see what it is that Facebook is doing with that information, how they're using it, and whether they're protecting users' online privacy even.
Right.
I mean, they're different industries, so you're never going to be able to say, let's line it up. It's all exactly like tobacco, but it's got the elements.
Mm.
It has all of the elements, enough to bring forward, I would say part of the answer is litigation.
Right. So here's my last question for you, Sharon, because to me, in a sense, there wasn't even any such thing as the big tobacco moment, right? It was the beginning of a major process that took far more than a decade. So that's what I want to know. What would it take now? What do you think, from your experience as being a former government counsel, are the next steps, or you would like to see as the next steps in what could become ultimately a big tech moment, or the process to making it a complete big tech moment?
Well, I think in the first place, we have to decide, we have to make sure that we bring the big guns. No more Mr. Nice Guy. That means potential litigation is a part of any solution. Even more evidence will come to light through discovery and litigation, but the government should conduct a thorough examination of all of its statutes and make a determination of whether what we know about the conduct of Facebook is actionable under any of those statutes. And if it is, they should bring cases appropriately. The other thing that needs to happen at the same time is regulation. We can't keep saying it's just too hard to do. We need to regulate this industry. And if that involves working with Mark Zuckerberg or his people, that's fine. Just have your eyes open about what you're looking at and insist on getting, you know, documents that you otherwise couldn't get just in the normal process without a lot of work. So I think a regulatory agency should have particular power to be able to request data from Facebook and the other companies, including data on how its algorithms work and the type of content that the algorithms amplify on Facebook's social media platforms. So I think a combination of litigation and legislation, making sure that external researchers get the data that they need to help inform the regulation is something that has to be done. Mm.
Well, Sharon Eubanks was lead counsel for the federal government in U.S. v. Philip Morris, the case that the federal government won against the big tobacco companies. Today, she is lead counsel at the National Whistleblower Center and author of Bad Acts, the Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. Sharon Eubanks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's listen now to some On Point listeners who said they like Facebook.
Catherine and Ananda Owens, Northfield, Minnesota. I was part of a community on Facebook that actually did some amazing things at the beginning of the pandemic. We had about 10,000 members from across the globe. I think our membership was more than 60 countries. And it far exceeded anything any of us individually would have been able to do within our own college or university. Social media is a tool, and it's a tool that can be used for good. It's a tool that can be used for ill. And I would hate to see us shut down the capacity for this kind of crowdsourcing, because it probably, in our case, literally saved lives.
Hello, my name is Mark Bez from Buffalo, New York. My wife and I are small business owners, and Instagram is our digital service of choice for advertising and speaking to customers and reaching out.
Hi, my name is Erin Sloan. I'm from Covina, California. And no, I have not quit Facebook because I think it is a great portal if you are a positive person. And as far as my children, of which I have five, on Instagram go, I think it's shameful that people have not had more accountability to their children's social media use, and they now want to blame the companies that have given us a positive tool to use.
Well, joining us now is Kate Klonick. She teaches internet law at St. John's Law School and is a fellow at the Brookings Institution as well. Kate Klonick, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Phil Weiser joins us as well. He's the Attorney General of the state of Colorado and is leading a coalition of 46 state attorneys general in an antitrust lawsuit against Facebook, as well as a coalition of 38 AGs in a lawsuit against Google. And he joins us from Denver. Attorney General Weiser, welcome to you.
Magnus, great to be with you.
So, Mr. Weiser, let me just start with you briefly. Describe to us the case currently that the 46 AGs have against Facebook. What are you alleging?
Over a period of really a decade or more, Facebook had a strategy. Either they were going to buy upstart rivals or they were going to bury them. And we compared Facebook's policies in terms of how they treated customers, how they treated private information, when there was more competition, when they were going head-to-head with MySpace versus when they had established their dominance. And they maintained their dominance through what antitrust lawyers would call predatory means, which is buying an upstart or telling an upstart, we're going to drive you out of business by denying access to information and finding ways to undermine you. So, for example, Vine was a rival service. They were driven out of business. Other services like Instagram and WhatsApp that posed real threats were purchased in a way to subvert the competitive process. That's not how our system is supposed to work. That's why we're in court against Facebook.
Okay. So that's, as I mentioned, that as you're describing, an antitrust case. But Kate Klonick, let me turn to you. Your take on whether this is Facebook's big tobacco moment, because as we talked about at the beginning of the show, before the big federal case, there were the cases brought by states' attorneys general. Is it similar here?
I think that Sharon brought up a number of great points about some of the similarities, the big kind of aha moment, the revealing documents, what people knew and when. I think that the difference between coming up with regulatory solutions for a product that is transnational, global, and is inherently all about speech and the sharing of speech and individual user speech via a private company is, it just is like a totally different animal than a product-based company like tobacco was.
Okay, so you're saying that this is not it's not a good analogy then?
I think it just falls short in the specifics by a lot. And I mean, Sharon said this. She said they're different industries. You can't compare these perfectly. But I almost think that, I mean, it's a good comparison in that all of a sudden, you know, we're having a moment in which we're coalescing some type of public sentiment around regulating something and making something better and holding the parties at hand responsible. But it is not this, it's just simply not, it's not going to have the same result as we had with big tobacco.
Okay. So Kate Klonick and Phil Weiser stand by, and Attorney General Weiser, I'm going to want to get your response when we come back from the break. We're talking about whether this week and the revelations from the Facebook whistleblower, including all the documents that she's given both to the Wall Street Journal and the federal government, do they constitute the beginnings of a big tobacco moment for big tech? And if not, what would it take? What actual actions need to come next? And as we head into the break, let's listen to a few more On Point listeners about what happened to them after they quit Facebook.
Hi, yeah. My name is Joe Green, and I'm calling from Lancaster in Pennsylvania.
Hi, my name is James Daniel from Cathlamet, Washington.
Hi, my name is Jeff Kindred. I'm from Reno, Nevada.
My name is Brent Thorson, living in Springfield, Ohio.
Hi, my name is Karen LaBrune. I live in Rosemont, Minnesota.
My name is Mark from Costa Mesa, California. The reason why I'm off of Facebook, which I've been off for 10 years, is that I give them permissions to track my activity on my smartphone, and that was the last straw. I'm done. I'm never going back. Thanks. Bye.
And really just seeing how much of my life is tracked by social networks and how much it's used for purposes that I don't value really helped me see that I didn't want to be a part of those social networks anymore.
I do not want my kids growing up with these types of social media influences, and it is doing more harm than good. We've never seen more divide in our country, period.
And so I really cut back, and I use tools like Apple's photo share albums between family members and friends now. And I found ways to kind of get around it that don't have the controlling aspects that Facebook has and serving you advertisements that you don't really want to see.
And I left Instagram because it's owned by Facebook. And honestly, my life is so much richer and more fulfilling without either of those things in it.
Even my daughter said, with this Facebook thing coming out, I'm so glad I'm not on Facebook. And basically, I think the trend is shifting, that it's not going to be cool anymore to have thousands of followers that mean nothing, because it's showing that these people are not having healthy relationships.
I discovered that by leaving Facebook, I am more engaged with my family. I reach out to people through text, or I even have started writing letters. And I've just found that that's made me feel like a human again. So thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Yes, this is Terry Fortman in Melbourne, Florida.
Hi, this is Alex from Vermont.
Hi, this is Daniel Benner from Oak Harbor, Washington.
Hi, my name's Matt, and I'm from Nashville.
Hello, my name is Berman Rivera, and I'm calling from Laredo, Texas. And for my case, I've been off of it for going on 4 years, and it really was due to a sense of nausea in opening the program and seeing nothing but a quality of information that was just negative, questionable in terms of its validity or its truthfulness from potential news sources, but also on many occasions, just peers and people that I know, family sometimes.
I deleted my Facebook account because of Facebook's undermining of democracy.
During the 2020 election, it is just so acrimonious, and there didn't seem to be any nuance in any discussions. And I can see how Facebook is set up for emotional knee-jerk reactions, and I kind of found myself falling into that too.
People have been disabled in their ability to reason about events.
And I've also heard a lot about the radicalization and white supremacy and conspiracy theories that's happening on Facebook, and I just don't really want to be a part of that. I think I don't want to see that side of people in my family if they are engaging with that stuff.
Our politicians are failing us. There should be massive regulation of all social media, and the fact that Mark Zuckerberg lost $7 billion in one day delighted me. As an old guy, wanted to see that punk taught a lesson about responsibility in a democracy worldwide.
Again, several of the listeners who called us with their thoughts about Facebook, and I will acknowledge they are a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the many billion users or the several billion users who happily use Facebook every day and multiple times a day. But nevertheless, we are talking about whether the recent revelations and documents from Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen constitute the beginning of a big tobacco moment for big tech, specifically for Facebook. And if not, what would it take to turn it into a big tobacco moment? And I'm joined today by Kate Klonick. She teaches internet law at St. John's Law School. She's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Phil Weiser is with us from Denver, Colorado. He's the attorney general for the state of Colorado. And Mr. Weiser, you heard before the break Kate talking about the fact that it's just a totally different industry. We're talking about global reach. We're talking about speech and things that are not so easily regulated. But you and 45 other states are bringing essentially an antitrust lawsuit against Facebook. Why take that path? Because I'm looking back at the 1988 settlement that the tobacco companies struck between state attorneys general then, and that was about deceptive business practice. Are you considering a similar lawsuit down those paths for Facebook?
So my job as attorney general is to protect the people of Colorado and work with other state AGs on issues of broad concern. And obviously, social media and big tech is a topic that deserves concern. And to Kate's point about, is this a tobacco moment? One dimension that it might be is the public getting a level of insight and awareness that something needs to change. That is a critical starting place. And as I took office in January 2019, I will tell you, among state AGs, there was a broad conversation. Some things need to change. And where this is not like tobacco is the dimensions that we're talking about are multidimensional. You noted, and we're fully engaged on the competition standpoint. And one of the problems is when you've only got one personal social networking platform and they control what's become two main rivals, as it were, WhatsApp and Instagram, there's not other places for people to go. It would be great to have a ecosystem where there was a commitment to, we're going to be super child friendly, we're going to be transparent in ways with you, that would force Facebook to have to respond. But given Facebook's dominance, we're not in that world. And one can say the same thing about Google and search. A second key point we need to acknowledge here is privacy, because that's something state attorneys general have been looking at. Obviously, with Facebook, the Cambridge Analytica scandal is something that FTC has acted on, but the states are still looking at. And also states like Colorado have adopted state privacy laws, and we're the third state to do so, to protect consumers when their information is being collected and maybe shared in ways they don't know about. So part of my point would be the same one that Kate made, which is, this is just way more complicated because it has multi dimensions to focus on: democracy, kids, competition, and privacy. And unlike tobacco, there's not a existing regulatory agency where we're like, okay, the FDA, game on.
Right.
We got to think about how might we create those new authorities and what does that all look like? So this is going to take a little bit of time. Even if the public is fully engaged, demanding action, like your last listener, it's going to be a little bit of a road from here to there.
Oh, that okay. So that's a really interesting point about no clear existing agency to turn to here. Kate Klonick, go ahead and respond.
Yeah, I agree with Phil about a lot, and I disagree with him on things. These are, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm so happy to hear from him on this. I listened to your listeners, and one of the things that I didn't hear, except for the people who were talking about the good things that Facebook gave them, was any type of specificity. And I heard a lot of anger and a lot of outrage and a lot of retribution. And I want to point out that, like, those people are blaming Facebook for that. But this show, all of media, all of these senators and congresspeople are also stoking that outrage at Facebook. And then they are coming back around and saying Facebook is making a profit out of outrage and we should hold them accountable. I just want to, like, point out how this is a fundamental part of kind of society, is to use outrage to, you know, for journalism to write salacious headlines to get more clicks and to sell more papers, and for, you know, for Congress people to get more donations and to pass the regulation or to get votes from their constituency. I'm not saying that people don't do things for the right reasons in all of those industries. I'm just saying there are things here that we have seen before, but the nature of this specific industry is so complicated that we can't be making decisions off of, we don't like Mark Zuckerberg personally and we're just thrilled to see him lose $7 billion. I'm sorry. That's a short-sighted, retributive type of idea that we don't want to reward in a democratic society.
So, you know, a point taken about the outrage machine, because absolutely, media has profited off of stoking outrage and high emotion for generations. I do take exception to saying this show, though, because we don't reach 2 billion people. We do not make a profit. We don't have the ability to algorithmically control the information, misinformation, lies, conspiracies, theories, ads, and true baby pictures that flood a person's mobile device or desktop computer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I think the thing about Facebook that people are growing, at least the listeners who contacted us, ever more concerned about is this issue of scale and ubiquity. Scale and ubiquity, which makes it categorically different than even some of the largest media companies out there right now. Don't you think, Kate?
Yes. No, I 100% think that this is an issue of scale and ubiquity. And I couldn't agree more. And this is one of the reasons that I think Phil's work with the AG's office is correct. And I didn't mean this show, like, as in this show in this moment. I meant, like, the media ecosystem at the moment, the outrage that is fomenting around all of this and kind of the playing of these clips of these outraged senators and all of these types of things. It is all part of kind of creating, like, and capitalizing on a moment of outrage. And some of that is useful. Like, we want to harness some of that to move this discussion forward and get to a point where we realize the real harms that these are creating. Phil has been working in this area for years. I've been working in it not as long, but, like, still for many, many years. And I think at this point, we're kind of getting to, I think there's a sense of relief from a lot of us that people are finally coalescing and paying attention to a lot of the things that a lot of smart people were warning about for a very long time that were happening in this industry. And that is the reason, if this is a big tobacco moment, that this is the big tobacco moment, because we are having one kind of person and one set of documents or many sets of documents kind of push us in that direction.
Yeah. So I completely hear what you're saying. And
I mean, the media, given what it is, sound bites tend to veer towards the emotional. Point well taken. But at the same time, we played a lot of Frances Haugen offering specific numbers about just how many teens self-report on Instagram of being addicted to Instagram. So there's actual data and information here that the public has not had before. And so that pushes me towards the question of, again, what to do now? If this is actually an issue that the public should have a say, if a society decides it wants to do something about, what should it be? So in part, to answer that, we reached out to Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, a terrific book. And she said, some folks have suggested breaking up Facebook, forcing it to sell Instagram, for example. But she says that won't even solve what she believes is the core problem with big tech.
Breaking up Facebook or any other large surveillance capitalist corporation does not solve this problem. I don't care if you break it up into 10 companies or 20, each one of them is still going to be operating exactly the same way. We've got to open up the hood and we've got to do open heart surgery on the engine. That's where the problem is. Institutionalized economic operations that are fundamentally illegitimate because fundamentally they amount to stealing from us what we have never agreed to give.
That's Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Phil Weiser, I mean, I know you're actively involved in some cases against Facebook, but take a step back here. I mean, what would you do? What do you think the next steps ought to be if we as a society think that this is a moment to consider some kind of new framework around big tech, around social media?
I want to start with Kate's point about we can't only have outrage. We have to have action. And that's why Josh Shapiro, Pennsylvania's Attorney General, and myself sent a letter to the committee holding hearings and made that point. The next step is federal legislation. And the federal legislation needs to establish regulatory authority over big tech, social media platform companies like Facebook, like Google. And it has to address multiple points. And I disagree with Shoshana's point that competition doesn't matter. Choice for consumers matters. If consumers could pick a search engine that protected their privacy or a social media platform that was committed to a different type of democratic discourse and enabling democracy, we'd be in a better world right now than the one we're in. So we have to promote competition. And that agency that needs to be established needs authority to promote competition. Data portability, interoperability are concepts that have been talked about for a while. As Kate said, we need an agency with authority to oversee them. We also need authority over privacy. And right now, a few states like Colorado are stepping into that domain. But ultimately, we need a federal framework to protect consumer privacy. And finally, the issues talked about the whistleblower this week around democracy, around kids and the algorithms, an agency who'd have the ability to have independent research to ensure academics had access to research and to have that dialogue. And finally, to take Kate's point about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, they don't know right now what rules of the road should govern. They're trying to make them up. I think they're being criticized for how they've done it. I understand those criticisms. I share many of them. But ultimately, the criticism has to be on the public. And I know one of your listeners talked about politicians need to act. We need to work towards this new regulatory framework to oversee companies that are so clearly impacting our society.
Mm. Well, Kate Klonick, there's also a specific recommendation that Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, seemed to offer during her Senate testimony. And that was that at the very least, can we come up with some regulations that would force Facebook, because they've been unwilling to do this before, but, make their data more transparent, make what they know about the effects of Facebook on societies easier to understand, give it to researchers. Would that be a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote this in a New York Times op-ed over the weekend. One of the interesting things that you're going to see without regulation is that all of the internal research that Francis had the benefit of leaking is not, one, going to happen anymore inside private companies. If you think that Google or Twitter or TikTok are all of a sudden turning inward and looking at how their services are harming their users right now, you've got another thing coming. I mean, in an age in which, like, we're going to have ubiquitous whistleblowers, there's not going to be these types of studies done and no more transparency. And so I think that we absolutely need to have this data and readily available to the public and to researchers. Ironically, Facebook has actually been one of the best actors on this. It tried to partner with outside social science in a faulty, like many levels of failure way, but there were good intentions, I think, on both sides. It's just a massively hard issue and a hard thing to like bring about. But a lot of other things that are happening, and Phil briefly alluded to Google search, a lot of these other companies are enjoying all of the, I would say, the outrage being focused on Facebook right now and using it to not make their companies better, even though they do the exact same things mm-hmm. as Facebook. And so there's also kind of a conversation to be had about broadening this industry wide and not just bringing all of this down on Mark Zuckerberg's head.
Without a doubt. I mean, so that's why we should call it big tech's big tobacco moment, perhaps, maybe more accurate. But we've just got a minute left. And Kate, I'm going to have you give you the last word here. I was so fascinated to hear Phil Weiser talk about, like, we may not even have the right regulatory agency to turn to help deal with, you know, with how we want to move forward as a country regarding big tech. So just now we got 30 seconds, Kate, here, but kind of give me your pie in the sky. Like, what are the next steps you think we ought to take as a country to deal with this? Because I think fundamentally everyone agrees on one thing. We want to be able to reduce harm while maximizing the good that big tech brings.
Right. And I just think that Phil could not be more on point. We've tried to think about managing this with the FTC, the FCC. We've thought about like letting it be answered by the courts. There's all types of things. We need a new agency and we need it to be staffed by smart people that understand this industry. And hopefully this is a watershed. Hopefully this is a watershed moment to seeing some long-term change, less outrage and more rational thought and action towards making the internet a safer and better place for all of us.
Well, Kate Klonick at St. John's Law School and fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Phil Weiser, Attorney General for the state of Colorado, joining us from Denver. Phil Weiser, thank you so very much.
Great to be with you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago. Okay.
Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.